Evening. I have no PowerPoint because, as you know, I'm a radio voice, so you can shut your eyes, lean back and listen. And indeed, I say that because I am here this evening, quite frankly, as a radio voice, because it was the fact that I broadcast on the privileged slot that used to be Alastair Cook's Letter from America, A Point of View, a 50-minute programme just after Higher Ambitions, Higher Ambitions, the recent report on higher education and science came out. I gave a broadcast on the Friday and the Sunday, which I'm happy to say some people in the room actually responded to on the website, and it was noticed by the organisers of this evening's event, and I was asked to contribute. Now, I think that that leaves me in a very nice position to get you all launched for the discussion, because I followed with great interest Mark Walpole's presentation, which indeed took us very nicely through what I'd already read in his report, which followed very well on the heels of the Higher Ambitions report. And I take all the points from John's presentation that we've just heard. But I'm going to talk to you rather differently. And I'm going to start with the crest, which you see in front of you here in the Royal Society. Your eyesight will not be good enough to read its motto, but I, as a historian of science, will remind you that that motto reads, Nullius in verba. And the translation of that motto is, take no man's word for it. And it's a motto that was coined beautifully, probably by John Evelyn in the 1660s, to capture the sense that science, the new science, was never to be taken on trust. It was to be taken, internalized, understood by every individual, great sort of utopian ambition, everybody in the English nation, which was what was being addressed, would internalize that understanding of the new science, and they would become functioning scientific members of the nation, the community in which they lived. Nullius in verba, take no man's word for it. Now, the problem with everything that we've heard this evening, from my point of view, is it simply doesn't go to the heart of the problem. Because the heart of the problem is, really, quite nice to have that last quote up, the quote about where is science leading us, to about, let me be pessimistic, 80% of the British public, is no different from a statement by a mullah or a cardinal or a bishop. It's a statement that has to be taken on trust, because most of those listening to it lack the competence to scrutinize and assess for themselves the body of material which is science. Now, that would be fine if science were, as Mark and John have so well shown us, you know, something to do with employability, to do with skills in the workplace, to do with, let's say, Britain's place in the world markets. But it's sort of shocking to me that we haven't yet mentioned that we simply inhabit a scientific world. I mean, if we didn't have electricity, we'd be sitting here with candles and no microphones. I mean, our whole experience of every moment of every day that we live is so underpinned by science that it is simply shocking the extent to which an ordinary member of the public, and of course nobody in this room comes into this category, is incapable of grasping not simply the foundations of the subjects in their specialisms, but the scientific method of argument which would allow them to assess the evidence if it were presented to them. Now, if I'm sounding a bit passionate, I am. I, as you've learned from my introduction, I have a habit of being a governor of primary and secondary schools, have done all my adult life, mostly because I had a number of children. It was the only way to keep them in the state sector, was to govern all the schools they were at. when I was on the governing bodies of primary schools, I became infamous when I sat on appointments committees, that when Miss Jones came in and showed us her dexterity on the recorder and how she could do leaf prints, or when Mr. Jones came in and showed us how he strummed on his guitar and told us how he would take them for nature walks, I would always ask them if they could teach the children how a lavatory flushed. And they would say no. And that, I mean, they wouldn't say no, of course. They'd just sort of fumble. And but although it makes you laugh, and it always made everybody on the committee laugh, it's a really serious matter. We've talked about the fact that teachers in primary schools are not specialists. We haven't talked about the fact that they mostly lack confidence precisely in the area where 5 to 11-year-olds need to be given a confidence simply to assess the information that they are being given. Now, if we take Stephen Hawking on aliens, what use is that to a public? That, I mean, that was a dreadful headline, John. Dreadful because I think Stephen is becoming too attention-grabbing. And dreadful because it actually did not mean anything serious and scientific to probably 90% of those who read the newspapers. They had no way of assessing what it was Stephen was trying to talk about. They certainly hadn't got beyond the first page of whatever, I've forgotten the title of his great book, A Brief History of Time. They, you know, everybody I know bought it. My husband once tried to a gentleman in a cafe in Paris, and even admitted himself he'd only got halfway through it. But those who are trying to respond to Stephen Hawking mostly have no idea what he could be talking about and no way of assessing it. Now, to go from the absurd, I think that one was slightly absurd, to the serious, amongst my Friday and Sunday broadcasts, I did one on climate change and about uncertainty in science and about the fact that that you never could produce entirely factual data. Incidentally, digression again, I do tend to digress, except on the radio. My own background is that I read, I did pure maths, applied maths and physics at A-level. I read 2 years of maths at Cambridge before changing subjects, and I then moved into history and the humanities, history of science. So I kind of worked example of what I'm trying to tell you we all really ought to try to be. That is competent to process information in a field like the likelihood of climate change being the result of human activity. The fact that the British public, and whatever that means, is swayed to and fro like a straw in the wind by bigots and pressure groups of various kind, and is unable to focus on what might be the problem for practicing scientists in the area in coming out with a convincing rather than plausible answer on the subject is part of what I'm trying to talk about. I can hear that I'm not saying that very clearly, so let me take it back to something for the last few minutes, take it back rather more to the script that was in my head before I got passionate about what we don't know, which is this: the take it back to essentially the two cultures. Take it back 50 years to C.P. Snow. Because actually 50 years ago, what C.P. Snow, and to some extent my father Jacob Bronowski, discussed had nothing to do with competition between the arts and sciences. Nothing to do with it. It was taken up by F.R. Leavis, it was taken up by humanities departments in universities as a kind of silo battle between the university disciplines. It got knocked off course as a discussion. I would actually say tragically knocked off course, because I think what we're hearing with these reports that come out now that say the same thing that's being said for the last 50 years over and over again without any noticeable impact on scientific education in the public at large. What we're hearing is that by knocking that discussion off course at the point at which it came fully into focus, we in this country, and it is largely in this country, are the losers. The series of essays by C.P. Snow, which are really relevant to our discussion tonight, are not those in The Two Cultures, which came out in 1959. They are in a much more interesting set of lectures, which I really encourage you to read, which came out in 1961, was completely overshadowed by what had already happened in the sort of spat at Cambridge between arts and sciences, which is called Science and Politics. Science and Government. I'm sorry, Science and Government. And it's a set of essays by C.P. Snow about how close to tragedy we came in the Second World War because nobody in government was equipped to assess the advice that was being given by scientific experts to Churchill. That's the short summary of the essays. The short summary of the essays is that in 1944, when all resources, all scientific resources were brought to bear on trying to bring Germany to its knees by aerial bombardment, the advice given by the statisticians closest to the government was disregarded, and the advice given by the chief scientific advisor was taken in its place, that advice being that the strategic bombing initiative would make it possible to bomb Germany into submission. The statistics for that, on the basis of which that decision was taken, Blackett, for instance, challenged. They turned out, after the war, I think it's still slightly moot, but they turned out to have been ill-founded. Huge numbers of our young airmen died, and we did not bring Germany to its knees. And the rest of the war, the mathematicians in the Department of, I always call it Homeland Security now, but in the Home Office, in which my father worked as a statistician, all of their efforts were turned to trying to optimise by what became known as operational research, how to optimise what was actually a very bad job in using the statistics of bombing, as I say, to try and bring Germany to its knees. Now, I mean, I happen to be looking at that at the moment because I'm making a documentary about that period and my father's work in that period, but the point about it that I'm trying to make to you is that what Snow said in these essays with a sense of real urgency was the cabinet had no way of judging which of these scientific proposals was the right one to adopt. No way whatsoever. So that in the end, the day was carried by the most powerful politician, the politician who was closest personally to Churchill, and the politician with the loudest voice. Now, to some very large extent, we still stand there today, and this is what I'm going to use to close. Another of my points of view I pointed out, and I'm not the first person to point it out, Mark Henderson, the Times correspondent, science correspondent, pointed it out, that the number of parliamentarians with an understanding of science of the kind that I am saying we all need is pitifully small and diminishing, and that the prospect for an advanced Western nation of its government being, if you like, permanently hostage to committees of scientists whose opinions can't be properly assessed by the parliamentarians because they don't have the wherewithal to do so, is a fairly frightening one. And I think maybe I'll stop there. But the gist of what I'm saying is, let us produce great scientists, let us produce more scientists. I have to tell you, I still do admissions at Queen Mary, or I don't, I oversee admissions from time to time. I have to tell you, when you saw that graph that John put up there of the increase in science students, now look, the four of you there, you knew that given that there were already 100 times more applicants for English than for physics, that's pretty well close. An increase of 10% in English applications, which is what you showed, is extremely large, and an increase in 40% in the pitiful number of students who apply to do mathematics is extremely small. And the last time that I went into our admissions hall for clearing and looked at the tables where it said, what are the offers we will take for a student in history? Well, we'll reduce 2 A's and a B to 2 B's and a C. What will we do for English? We'll reduce 3 A's to 2 A's and a B. What do we need for maths? And it said very firmly on the table, a detectable pulse.